So last class, we began discussing chapter 7, and we discussed the topics of the adversities of life and how wisdom can help us see us through and understand those difficulties, and in some cases, better ourselves through those adversities. And we discussed death, the realization of death and death all around us can help us improve ourselves. You know, we can take it to heart and to be better, and rebuke. Also the same thought, the adversity of rebuke, what we can learn from it, how we can grow from it. Maybe it's a rebuke from the wise. And how the those in agreement, the laughing with fools, is has no value at all. And oppression, that though there is oppression, the best way to live with it is to patiently endure it and to control one's anger. And that way you can live through the times of oppression and get the best out of it. Get, you know, you can survive it and do the best you can in that, in face of that adversity. And we stopped right at the end of the section on poverty and prosperity in verses 11 through 14. We saw that wisdom is good. It gives life, and it gives life, you know, regardless of whether we have prosperity or adversity. Adversity, which is in this case compared to prosperity, is poverty. And we know that, you know, money is good, but wisdom is better because it'll see you through both. And there may come the day in adversity when you don't have any money, and you'll be in poverty. And we ended right at verse 14. We know that both poverty and prosperity are from God, that God has appointed them. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. And of course, I think this, someone might have asked, what this coming after him is, what man doesn't get to know, and I believe discussing that, you know, in the context here is talking about why is it that, you know, some get poverty, some get prosperity, or that, you know, God points both to some people. And it's not an answer that we get, it's not a question we get answered. We don't get the answer. But we have to prepare for, you know, the possibility of either. I mean, wisdom will see us through both cases. So beginning in verse 15 through 18, I don't know exactly how to call this. So I just call it the adversity of when everything seems backwards. You know, when stuff is topsy-turvy, when life doesn't meet our expectations in some ways. In 15, Solomon says, I have seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. So, here we see wickedness is prosperous, and the righteous suffer. The righteous perish, and the wicked days are prolonged. Does that seem right to us? It goes against our expectations, doesn't it? And we also see that same thought in chapter 8, 12 through 13. Though a sinner does evil 100 times, and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are a shadow, because he does not fear God. And so we see both cases, too, the same observations made by the preacher, that sometimes the wicked prosper. Sometimes, you know, we expect, you know, the wicked are supposed to be judged, right? Based on what we want, the idea of our idea of justice. The wicked should be judged immediately, and they're to be cut off. But in this case, we don't see that. It's contrary to the general rule. And of course, we didn't just make this up. Of course, it's what we desire. We desire justice. We don't like, you know, oppression and wickedness. But we see in the Bible that that general rule is applied in cases. But this is exactly what it is a general rule. In Proverbs chapter 3, in 1 through 2, verse 1 through 2, "My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you." And also in chapter 9. And I had down here verse 11 through 12, but I think I meant 10 through 11. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. For by me your days will be multiplied, and the years of your life will be added to you. And also in verse 27 of chapter 10, "The fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked will be shortened." And so all these cases we see, the good, their days are to be prolonged, and the wicked, their days are to be cut off. And, you know, maybe we know that this isn't an absolute rule, is it? The observations of the preacher show this. It's not an absolute truth. And it's something we want to see, you know, the idea of the justice in it, but it's not absolute. So, how then should one live? The preacher makes that recommendation. How then should we live in the face of, you know, we may not be able to prolong our days with righteousness, and the wicked may in fact get the lengthier days. Yes, a balanced life. And we got into this in our Bible study Friday night. we have a balanced life. And we're to avoid two extreme cases. The cases of extremity. I'd also like to read in Proverbs 25 this same thought. Verse 16 of 25. It says, "Have you found honey? Eat only as much as you need, lest you be filled with it and vomit." And of course, you know, this is just a general rule. We know that when you go to excess, it's usually not good for you. And of course, you know, when you eat excessively, it's not going to be pleasant. And so that's the comparison we're seeing here is, you know, the two cases of excess, to be extremely wicked or to be devoted to righteousness and goodness. And it's, you know, if you make an example, kind of like, you know, if you have someone who's trying to live healthy, and there's a lot of people on the health kick right now that, you know, "Oh, I don't eat any processed foods, I don't eat any sugar, I eat only organic foods, and I work out, you know, 7 days a week, every day. Now I'm gonna extend my life." Now I don't eat any of that bad stuff. I mean, that stuff, it might taste good. I only eat whey shakes, whey protein shakes or something. They're horrible, but I'm gonna live a long time. I don't want any of that stuff that might taste good. It's bad for me. And so, you know, are they guaranteed a long life because because of their actions? They're trying to live healthy. It's not guaranteed, is it? They might get a stomach ulcer. They might have any, you know, genetic illnesses passed on from parents that has nothing to do with, you know, your own behavior. And of course, we all know that you don't live forever anyway, so they're still going to die. But he may still die young, despite his efforts to live a long time. And that whole time, in that extreme, excessive case, he didn't have any enjoyment from the things he could have eaten, the things he could have done. He, you know, worked out all the time. He didn't spend any time extra. He didn't, like I said, he didn't enjoy, you know, eating pleasant things. And then, boom, he dies early, and man, that stinks. He could have had it the other way. And, of course, it doesn't, you know, it swings both ways. You don't want to go to the other side of overindulgence. And of course, when you go to food and whatnot, we know that if you overindulge, hurts your body. And you know, like people who say, "Oh, I smoke," and you know, he lived. You know, my father smoked for all his life, and he lived to be 90. You know, somehow he made it. It doesn't apply to everybody. We know that it's bad, and it will probably get you. So, we have here this excessive case of righteousness. And what does it say? In verse 16, it says, "Do not be overly righteous, nor overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself?" How is it that the righteous one here will destroy himself? Or I guess you say, how do you think? Because it doesn't tell us why.
Giving his perspectives or priorities out of order. Doing, quote, righteous things and forgetting about things that need to be done. You know, that are, like I said, priority things. You can say, "Oh, I'm doing all this good, doing all this," what you consider good. It may be. Yeah. It may be harmless. But if you're forgetting about the other things that God's given you to do, then you've got things out of perspective.
Yeah, so it's a matter of unbalanced. It's, of course, you know, it's not saying here, "Oh, well, he's just too righteous. He needs to add a little bad in his life. You know, he needs to break the rules some." You know, is that, you think, what he's connoting here? Or recommending? Mm-hmm. No. He's talking about in the excessive case, you know, it's possible to, you know, devote yourself so entirely to being wise, to being good, that you easily give up any enjoyment in life. We know we're supposed to help people and everything, but if you go around helping everyone else all the time, maybe, you know, you put aside your own family, you know, just an example, you know, then you're doing something good which turns bad because you're neglecting your own responsibilities, as you said, your own responsibilities, the things that you need to do. Or, you know, there's lots of examples here we give out, and we don't have them all listed for us.
I think of Paul as being excessively righteous whenever he was persecuting Christians and killing them. Would that be a good example to use? He thought he was righteous, but he was being excessively righteous. I know he was very zealous. I mean, I don't know if it's talking about zeal here, but I think about Paul as an example here, as he went way to the extreme of being righteous.
I wouldn't use that here. I mean, because I see kind of what you're saying. One could go excessively righteous, but you're trying to say how he persecuted others and hurt others.
Well, not that. I'm just saying, like, because of his zeal. That's what he was known for. I mean, I may be making a totally wrong application here. But
there was nothing wrong with his zeal. Things were wrong was it was misdirected. He had the same zeal when he became a Christian. Same zeal. Just directed a different direction.
Yeah. He was doing wrong, but under the direction he had, it was doing right. And we see that misdirection, we go, "Oh, well, that was bad." I don't think you can know it was bad, but to him it wasn't bad. I don't know. It's
I'm just struggling with this excessively righteous part.
Okay, so, yeah. Okay. I mean, it is difficult, but I would say, I had another example about, what did I have? Okay, like we know Catholics, they say, you've got to be righteous, you've got to be pure. And so our ministers or preachers, whatever they call them, they got to be more righteous than everyone else. Therefore, they can't marry. They've got to abstain from marriage. And that makes them more righteous. Does it?
Look at the news.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make them more righteous. Does it? I know I've read, it's just something that came to me a long time ago, but, you know, there have been, I know, cases throughout history where men, you know, if I'm going to give myself to God, I'm going to focus on Him, I'm going to be righteous for God. And they come up with all these different strategies and theologies of how to put off all enjoyment, to abstain from food. They only eat just enough to keep them alive. For I remember reading one case where one man, you know, Pastor, I don't remember who it was, but you know, he was some guy who was bent on wisdom and knowledge, and he read a lot. He was a scholar, And when he became a Christian, he said, I'm going to devote myself to God, to being righteous. I'm going to put away everything I would enjoy. So I'm never going to read another book again the rest of my life except for the Bible. And so, you know, they call that to being, you know, oh, when you're righteous. But, you know, I would say that's an excessively righteous. I mean, it's a play on a term. I mean, does that make him more righteous? Yes, he's devoting himself to God. We see that as being more righteous, but at the same time, he's hurting himself. You're abstaining from something you don't need to abstain from, like marriage. Marriage, God gave us marriage, and it's good. To say that, you know, and it fits right along in here with what we're reading in Ecclesiastes, to say, oh, I'm going to be righteous, so righteous for God, that I'm not going to enjoy anything in life. I'm going to focus completely on him. And what have we seen multiple times, the recommendation in this book? What are we supposed to do with our lives?
Enjoy.
Enjoy. God gave us these things to enjoy. This isn't comparing to being righteous versus, you know, say, oh, don't be too righteous, therefore be wicked. It's just a matter of, there's plenty of things that are neutral in life. They are neither righteous nor wicked. You know, enjoying the food we have, enjoying family, just enjoyment of life isn't righteous in and of itself, and then neither is it wicked, unless it becomes an excess. I think that's what he's saying here, is this extreme case of neglecting everything else. Does that make sense, David? Because, I mean, this is a difficult passage, and people, I'm certain, lots of people take this and read it the wrong way. and it's certainly not a case for, you know, yeah, we need to break the rules sometimes, and we don't want to be too righteous. That's bad. So we gotta sin a little bit. Certainly not what it's saying at all.
Michael, I have a footnote on "Do not be overly wise" in Romans 12:3. But through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you, do not think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. So I don't know, that kind of helps me explain why should you ruin yourself, that it could cause
self-exaltation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly something you have to be careful of. You need to exalt yourself over others.
Michael, I think your explanation has been excellent, and it may help, I don't know if it will or not. He says, do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. We tend to use the word "and" as an addition, in addition to, as if there are two different things here. But oftentimes the word "and" introduces an explanation of what's just been said. For example, and several times in this book, just give one that I think is pretty clear, is in 5:6. 5:6, he says, do not let your feet cause you to sin. Now, if we just isolate that phrase, we could make that mean lying, slander, cursing, blasphemy. But if the word "and" introduces a more specific idea of what he means by that, what he means is, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. The sin in speech in view is making a vow and say, oh, I'm sorry, I have a mistake. That's the kind of sinful speech in view. And to let "and" introduce an explanation, we have a clearer and more precise understanding of what the writer is talking about. Now, when you get over here to this passage, do not be excessively righteous. And the word "righteous" in the Bible is the word we better interpret contextually. Obviously, if you're talking about justification, no one can be excessively righteous. Right? No one can be righteous.
Yeah.
It's only by the grace of God. Sometimes the word "righteous" refers to right living. And so if the word "and" introduces an explanation, do not be excessively righteous, and, what do you mean? Do not be overly wise. The contrast is, excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. You have, all the way back in chapter 2, the contrast between a wise man and a fool. One who tries to use some judgment about life, and the other fellow who doesn't. And so, if excessively righteous refers to, as you, I think, clearly point out, devotion to wisdom, or excessively wicked, devotion to folly, throw wisdom out the window. That's the context of what he's talking. And when you get to chapter 9, your illustration that you gave of the family fits perfectly here in verse 9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your freedom, like as you've given you under the sun. So you come in from work, and Amy says, you know, Michael, let's spend some time together just visiting, or maybe watching a movie or whatever. Or supper's on the table. I'm sorry, Amy, I can't. I've got to study Bible. I've got to read tomorrow night. Well, you didn't have time. Like, let's spend some time. No, I've got to read the Bible. I've got to study. Next night, well, I can't. I'm going to go teach a class. Next night, and you do this, what's going to happen? You're not going to enjoy life with the woman you love. And that's the kind of thing that I understood what you were saying, what you were talking about. Just instead of looking at Ecclesiastes, for example, if we mistake, we spend all of our time studying the book of Ecclesiastes and not practicing what it says about life.
That's correct. Yeah, it's this complete devotion to being wise, to being right. It results in sacrifice and neglect of all else, and that's the wrong choice you want to make. That's an excess. We need a balance. Of course, it's just destruction of the righteous man is, I believe, is this act of he's ruining himself through sorrow and this lack of enjoyment in life. And when we talk about balance, we have to look at the other side of the coin. For the one who, verse 17, do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? And of course here, this one's so much simpler to get because of the expectations we already have is the way we view things is, yeah, the wicked, they're supposed to die. They're supposed to have judgment immediately. So we know that we see here that the one who's excessively wicked will die before his time. You know, it's not this isn't talking about, may or may not be talking about God's judgment, but we know if you're excessively wicked, you're a disorder, you're a chaotic influence to a community. So the community itself may, turn against you. And so, it doesn't say that here, but we know those things are the case. But anyone who's excessively wicked is going to die. It's going to end in the shortening of their lives. And so we need, we don't want to go to the other way, to the complete abandonment of all wisdom. The answer is a balance of the two.
Mike, do you think that's not talking about quality of life? I mean, their lifetime could, as far as years, could go, who knows what, because we see that in life, that a wicked person could live, and you might think, well, that's unfair. That's all he's done all his whole life. Is live wickedly, serve Satan, and to hurt others, but yet that still happens. I mean, I don't know. I'm asking questions. It's not talking about quality of life.
You're talking about the death of his, the ruin. I don't think so. I think it's talking about his die before your time. When you talk about when you're going back, you're being relative. You're talking about relativity versus a wise man. If the wise man dies early and then the wicked man lives just a little bit longer, relatively, he had a longer life. But here we're talking about, he doesn't say that. He just says he dies before his time. You compare against his own life. If he hadn't been wicked, he might have gotten to live longer. And I think this may or may not fit in with what I was saying there. If this person is overly wicked, he's foolish. We're talking about two extremes. Certainly, almost never, like we pointed out, no one's the complete righteous. No one's ever met that pinnacle of perfection. And of course, no one is. Well, I would say no. Most people are never ever completely wicked. And all that they do, they seek only wickedness. there's, you know, those are, we're looking at two extremes, but two extremes that most people never ever achieve. You know, we're looking at this range, and we're just comparing, don't go too far that way and don't go too far the other way. But yeah, like what Sam wanted to say was, yeah, if you're closer to the wicked side, everything you do is overly wicked, you're probably going to die before your time. You know, we see murderers and everything. Eventually, it ends in their life. Something happens that gets them. Now, they may get to live longer than the wise man sometimes. The wise man may be in his car. You know, he's good. And he gets in a car accident. Boom, 22. And he's gone. And there's a wicked kid running around, and he makes it 30. Well, he got to live longer. But 30, if he had been righteous, he might have gotten to live longer time. So we got to be careful of who we're, you know, what we're judging against relatively. And so I think here, the wicked will die earlier than perhaps they would have, or than that God might have appointed more time for them. So we don't know if it's God's judgment or just the judgment of men here, or, you know, being in wicked situations usually ends up putting you more at risk.
So does that mean then that just the actions of the wicked increase their odds of dying early?
I would say so, yes. Okay. It says here they are going to die before their time.
They aren't necessarily, but it increases their odds because of their actions.
Well, that's where I was getting at, trying to show is the relatively nature of other people. I think if you look at just his life, mm-hmm. and say, you know, we can't do this. We can't say, if this man was righteous, he would get to live X years. Mm-hmm. Oh, if he's wicked, X minus 10.
Okay, so take Hugh Hefner. He's old as the hills, and he's definitely wicked.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, because we judge everything relatively.
Okay.
You know, we look at the wise man who, a lot of people, how old is he? He said 80 or something?
I don't know, but
he's old.
Awful old.
You know, a lot of good people don't get to be that old. But now we're judging relatively against something else. You know, and that's, we cover this, I think we discussed it before, we're going to cover it again. You know, in the Ecclesiastes, we just don't get to know these things. But here we have two cases, and we're not to go to the excess of either case. We're supposed to have a life of balance. Not between, balance or lies between being wicked and being righteous, of course, but, you know, we need to, you know, be righteous, but not complete devotion. Not, you know, that's a tricky word we get into, but we don't need to do it to the neglect of everything else, the other responsibilities, and the neglect of enjoying our lives. And what is the recommendation in both extremes? In verse 18,
fear God.
And we're to fear God. And in all cases, we're to fear God. Says he who fears God will escape them all. Of course, we know if you fear God, you won't live a life of wickedness or righteousness. I think also if you fear God, that complete devotion to being wise, to righteousness, if you fear God, you'll see, like we see here in Ecclesiastes, that we should have enjoyment. We should, you know, take the time we have with our families and acting out those things. We know if we fear God, we won't get that distorted view of just, I mean, of course God needs to be the utmost in our lives. So that whole concept making me very difficult to get the right wording. I think you know what I'm trying to say. But if we fear God, we will have the right balance based on the commandments he's given us. We know we have responsibilities to our family. We know we have responsibilities to God. And we'll achieve that right balance, and we'll be better off for it. And in verse 19, he begins a new topic, the prevalence of sin. In 19 through 22, it says, wisdom strengthens the wise, more than 10 rulers of the city. For there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. Also, do not take to heart everything people say. lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. And so we see here wisdom gives strength more than 10 men of the city. And we're to be wise and know what thing about sin and about man.
We're all susceptible to it.
That's right, we're all susceptible to sin. There is not a single man who is good who does not sin. Everyone sins. We see 1 Kings 8:46. And it points out the same thing in the Old Testament. When they sin against you, for there is no one who does not sin, and become angry with them, and deliver them to the enemy, and take them captive land. It's talking about the other men in the land of Israel when they were conquering them. The important thing is here is there is no one who doesn't sin. You know, good or wicked, whatever title we want to put on people, respectable, you know, wise, all men are sinners. And it's the same in Romans 3:23. One from the Old Testament, one from the New Testament. It says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." So this is a rule that a rule of men that we are all sinners. you'll see. Of course, this is in a time when people had servants. Your servants are going to sin. In this case, they're cursing their master. But he points right back at him and say, "You see that happen? You know what do you what do you, in wisdom? What are you to know?" You know, you're to know that you yourself has done, you have done the same thing. You yourself have sinned. You yourself have cursed others as well. And so, this wisdom will strengthen one to know how to act accordingly in your lives and how to respond. You know, it'll keep you from the despondency of the prevalence of sin. You know, some people, you know, even now we look around and people say, "Oh, everything was so much better in the 50s. Whenever the 40s, sin just becomes so rampant. It's, you know, multiplying. Our nation is, it's getting worse." And I'm not saying any of that's true or untrue, but, you know, sin was with us even when we thought things were good. Sin's always been here. And of course, you know, there's always masking of sin. Maybe in the 50s, people just covered it up better. I know, you know, back then people were ashamed to get a divorce or to have children out of wedlock, but it still occurred. Now, it's just the fact people are still doing it and they're just more open about it. That's certainly horrible. But sin has always been here. We've all, it's something all men have been with. We've never been without it. We don't need to let it get us down. To realize that men sin, you know, you're not going to be shocked by it. It's not going to be, "Whoa, man, things, you know, yeah, this is the way it is." You're not going to have this disappointment of life. And also, it prevents, and I know you were discussing this earlier, prevents self-righteousness and exalting oneself. You know, certainly, that's, you know, something that people can be susceptible to, is, "I'm good," and you see sin and you rebuke it, which everyone should do, but you come down extremely hard, and be more like me, I'm better, and this and that, and they really crack down on people roughly. You know, we don't need to exalt oneself or put oneself on a pedestal. We're all sin. You're capable of sin, and knowing that can temper your, you know, give you more understanding and give you temperance and how to deal with the situation, you know, and dealing with people when you find them in sin. And of course, it also prevents an unmerciful attitude toward others. And of course, it sort of fits in with the same thing I was just saying, is temperance. But yeah, I mean, we have to have mercy. It's, you know, otherwise you're playing the hypocrite. You know, slay them for this, but are you any less guilty of things yourself?
I was just thinking that, you know, when you come on merciful attitudes and humility, when you point out the sins of another, maybe something you don't do, but they do, well, you've got weakness yourself, and how many sins does it take to get you to hell, to get you condemned? We're all going to do so. So it's really, it's a frivolous thing to to do that, because you know, you're in the same situation without the Lord gone. You have no chance yet.
And yeah, that's, you know, of course that's going a little out of the context of what we're talking here, but I mean, it's not necessary. It's no less untrue.
I understand.
And of course, and that's again, you know, that's our nature of judging relatively. We like to judge relatively, you know. You say, oh, well, I have, okay, yeah, maybe I have this much sin. But you have this much sin, and so you're worse. And I'm better. And you're right, you know, it only takes, you know, sin is sin, and on everyone it's the same, the outcome is the same. And so, yeah, we know how to, the knowledge of this will help us, prepare us through a life that's going to be filled with sin, sin with others and our own sin as well. We needn't let us, you know, get us disappointed or shocked by any of the things we're going to see, and prevent you from living your life correctly. And beginning verse 23, he goes into the explanation of all of this. And I ask you to mark, you know, all the instances of promoting the idea of seeking, finding, and knowing the preacher is given here. I think I came up with 11. There's 11 different instances where throughout these scriptures, these verses, he's talking about seeking and trying to find the answer to the explanation of wickedness. Verse 23, it says, "All this I have proved by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? I applied my heart to know, to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her." Here's what I have found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. Truly this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And so we see here, he's in verse 25, he's seeking to know through wisdom. Verse 25, he's seeking to know the answer to wickedness and folly, of foolishness and madness. And does he have an explanation for why man sins? Why is man driven to folly and madness?
He sought out his own device. He seeked what he wanted to do. And it started from the beginning. That's thinking about God put within us some block. And we think we ought to do what we want to do versus God, and that's what happens. Is you get into sin.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's talking about here. I sought out what devices, and there's all kinds of ways that can happen, which the Lord warns us about it. Bottom line, you did what you wanted to do versus God.
Yeah. I guess you can answer that question. It's a trick question. So I don't know. You can answer yes and no. And no, he never did find out the answer why man sins. Why does man sin? And, you know, we don't know why. You know, I guess he doesn't know why man sins. He knows he has some explanation for it, though. And it's like you said, Mr. Porfield, we deviate from what God wants. You know, in verse 29, he says that God has made man upright. But, I don't know if I yet. Okay, he says, God made man upright. And we know that when God made man in Genesis 1, 27, so God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created him. And in verse 31, and God saw everything that he has made, and indeed it was very good. So God made man upright, he made everything good. His, you know, there isn't a flaw in God's design. God's design is right. But God gave man a choice. And in that choice is where we've gone astray. We deviate from God's design. We're disobedient to his will. And that's the reason why there is wickedness in the world. I guess it doesn't explain why. We don't know why man chooses that way, but we have the choice, and that's what becomes of it. And of course, I don't know. There's a whole lot of other stuff in here about women. I don't know what to make of all of that, but we do know, you know, that I guess this, the, some people point out this is, you know, pointing to the I guess this is, an indicator of where Solomon is at in his life. And this is, you know, this points to the sort of to the end of his age there. He has this bitter resentment, I guess, to women. And of course, we know he had 1,000 wives, or not 1,000 wives, but 1,000 women, 300 wives, 700 concubines. And he had too many. And of course, we know he chose from amongst the other, you know, from women outside the nation of Israel, at least to some extent. You know, we know he had wives from Egypt. You know that there was ones among them who wanted from Amnon and from the other areas for the of the nations that God told to destroy, and they didn't finish them off, and they led his heart astray. And you know, it points here, it says, one man among 1,000 I have found, but a woman among all these I haven't found among 1,000. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting too big. I didn't want to get into it, but because it says a bunch of stuff here, and I don't know how to take it. I think what you can take is that here he's showing that, you know, women, I guess in one respect, he's looking for the answer of wickedness. And here, in part, he points to women as some women who are their snares, who act as snares and nets. They can drag man down into wickedness. And we see that from the first in Adam and Eve is not blaming Eve, but that's the situation that happened. That she brought man down as well. But all of it results in man leaving God's design.